How many of you remember a scene like this? The campfire crackles down to glowing embers. The night shadows creep towards you from a dark wall of trees. A sudden chill tightens the back of your neck. And somebody says, "Tell us a ghost story." It was fun to be frightened, as long as we could touch someone on either side, and as long as the counselor had a big flashlight to turn bears back into bushes on the way back to our tents. We rather expected a ghost story in such a place, but we do not expect one in sacred scripture, and especially with Christ himself as the teller of the tale. But there is one, a creepy story, hard to forget, especially if you read it with imagination and see the silent rooms, the broken windows, the strange white faces peering out. But all this is to run ahead of ourselves, because we are not yet ready to read it. We need a 20th century preface if the ancient story is to make any sense. Let's suppose for a moment that someone has talked you into reading Dante's Divine Comedy, a vast, sprawling, medieval poem about the afterlife. And let's suppose that you are wise enough to wonder whether you need to make any special preparation before you start. If I were the one to whom you spoke, I would recommend that the best way to read that huge work with pleasure and profit would be to recreate the thought world out of which it came, to learn something about number symbolism, about Italian politics, about the history of the Catholic Church, about all the superstition and science of the Middle Ages. The point is that we have to do some of that same recreation of context if we hope to read the Bible well. That equally vast and complex work, written over 1,000 years by many different people whose culture and thought forms are often either unknown or very puzzling to us. For example, in the time of Christ, belief in demons was widespread. The world was not round, but flat, with layers. God lived up there somewhere, above the sky, in a region of calm. People were at home on the solid earth, and in between was an atmosphere filled with invisible creatures, among them a host of evil spirits, watching for some crack or crevice by which they might enter into human bodies and cause trouble. Some poor man the doctor might diagnose today as schizophrenic was believed then to be whipsawed back and forth by fierce battles between the powers of good and the demons who had invaded his mind. A child with epileptic seizures was thought to be possessed of a devil. A lady of the evening who scandalized the whole country was said to have 7 devils living in her, because 7 was the Jewish number which meant the ultimate. That popular belief in demons provides the setting for the grim story which Jesus told and you heard Lindsay Giles read a few minutes ago. When an unclean spirit comes out of a man, it wanders over the desert seeking a resting place. Part of the mythology was that evil spirits liked to be where it was dry. And finding none, it says, I will go back to the home I left. So it returns and finds the house unoccupied, swept clean and tidy. Off it goes and collects seven other spirits, more wicked than itself, and they all come in and settle down. And in the end, that man's plight is worse than before. Now, the danger for a modern audience when it hears a story like that is that parts of it sound so strange and unbelievable that the lasting truth in it gets overlooked. Demons that come out of people, wander about, talk over their plans, and then come back with seven more demon buddies. Not many people like you believe in that kind of demon possession. And so you get stopped with this ghost story before you get well started, which is regrettable because it has something to say to us even in a less superstitious time. But before we come to that, we can't help wondering how Christ himself felt about such things. Did he simply accommodate himself to prevailing ideas so as to communicate with people who would not have understood him otherwise? Or was he in such things a true child of his times? Does our reverence for his moral genius require that we attribute to him in the first century the scientific knowledge of the 20th? In order for him to teach people how to live, was it necessary also that he have advanced knowledge of medicine and diseases? Some of you will remember my telling you a few weeks ago about a minister I heard in Tacoma who assured all of us in the audience that Jesus knew all about penicillin and oreomycin, but didn't tell us because he wanted us to pray. Probably the most extraordinary statement I have ever heard from a pulpit. Jesus seems to have accepted the popular folklore about weather signs. He spoke of that mythology one time without making any effort to correct any misconception that was part of it. Are his ethical insights invalidated because meteorology was not yet a science? The fact is, it's hard to know when Jesus shared the views of the world in which he was born and when he didn't. Sometimes he takes direct issue with a superstition, as he did the day he contradicted the notion that blindness is invariably the result of somebody's sin, or that any catastrophe has to mean that God is intervening to punish the wicked. His world in general believed such things. He rejected them. But there would be a limit to how far he could go out of the thought world of his time, even if he were able and still communicate with those who lived in it. In some ways, he had, by the laws of life, to be a man of his own times. In other ways, he was a man for all times, which is why we have churches like this one created in his name. Fortunately, we don't have to settle that matter, because for us, the important thing to take from this old ghost story is that if we get disgusted with one way of life and give it up, we'd better do more than simply clean the house of our personality, because it requires a tenant. Emptiness will not work. Gertrude Stein says in her autobiography that some of the intellectuals she met in Paris seemed to her to suffer from a nothingness. She meant that they belonged to nothing. They were mastered by no great loyalty. They had, to use Vachel Lindsay's phrase, no gods to serve. Their house may have been swept clean of nonsense, but it had no owner, no occupant. The clearest thing in life is that we are not made to be self-sufficient and totally independent. The master of our souls, no matter how heroic those lines from Henley's poem may sound, we were designed to belong to something or to somebody. We're witnessing this on a grand scale right now with regard to Russia, as one of the most incredible displacements in history takes place. Mr. Gorbachev did a remarkable job of sweeping the house and evicting some undesirable tenants, and his posted notices about perestroika and glasnost struck us as marvelous, but he was a little slow to fill the house with new tenants. And a demonism that might have been worse than ever almost moved back in to take charge. I use the word demonism in a non-literal but deliberate way. It's hard to find a better word for describing what gets into people like Donald Evans down in Mississippi, who confesses to having killed 60 people, or into Jeffrey Dahmer up in Milwaukee, whose horribly distorted personality made him a man to whom, if you tried to say goodbye, he always found a way to keep you around. There must have been a time when those two men were in transition, when the soul and its house were empty and waiting for new tenants, and the wrong ones moved in. The one thing our parable says this morning is that the house won't stay empty, that something will invade us, that the only real choice we have is to choose which guest it will be. Neutrality is a fiction, one of those vacuums nature is said to abhor. Something will move in on the uncommitted mind, and seeing room may invite seven other guests, all less welcome than it is. This story of a haunted house is one of many ways by which Christ attacked the official religion of his time, because it was so negative, so busy throwing out unwelcome visitors that it forgot to invite in good ones. I have some sympathy for that tight-lipped older lady who admitted once that she didn't think much of the Ten Commandments. She said, "They give people ideas." And I think she had a point. It is never enough to say, thou shalt not. We have to be for something and we have to serve something. The people truly committed to the life of this church, for example, are those who care enough to come, as you have done this morning, and be a part of it. Your coming, after all, even when you are not perfectly in the mood, lifts the spirits of others who come. I remember the man who asked a famous mountain climber one night at a dinner why mountain climbers rope themselves together. After all, if one falls, won't that endanger all the rest? And the climber, probably weary of such questions, said, oh, it's not so much for safety as it is to keep the ones who are not crazy from going home. And I want you to know that I'm happy about those who are here each week, even if their greatest contribution so far has been to keep the rest of us from giving up. I also appreciate people who, once they've accepted appointment to a board, show up, even when it's not convenient, because to do otherwise is to embrace the idea that commitment is not an important thing. The fact is that commitment means power, which is why a few people who believe something passionately can overwhelm a majority that is merely drifting. I suppose another way to put it is that we need a box, a frame at least, around our lives. They can't be shapeless if we hope to be happy. We learn that, oddly enough, even from our vacations. A vacation is fine precisely because it exists within a frame, because it is bounded on both sides by commitment. Without those boundaries, it can turn into tedium, into a wasteland of boredom. George Bernard Shaw said once that an eternal vacation would be for him a good definition of hell. And I recall the retired man who was asked what his main problem was now that he was free of commitments. He said it was insomnia. I can sleep all right at night, he said, and during the morning. But late in the afternoon, I just pitch and toss. He had too much of nothing but himself to deal with, and nobody can stand that. My children got me into Silver Dollar City once, years ago. And one of the few things I remember is that I took my daughter, who is looking at me at this very moment, through a hall of mirrors. She laughed at first, and then she began to feel a little lost and nervous because we were surrounded by nothing but images of ourselves, some too thin, some too fat, some too tall, some too short. Here, what seemed to be an open aisle, turning out to be a solid mirror. There, what seemed to be a doorway to the outside, turning out to be still another mirror. She didn't cry, but her hand squeezed a little harder by the minute. And we both felt relief when we got outside into the open where we could see something everywhere we looked besides ourselves. You can count on one thing. People bounded by themselves are miserable. This church exists to make the argument that it is possible to escape that effect in life itself, where it becomes so terrible and suffocating, the closed room, the dead end, the empty feeling, The faith we profess in this place tells us again and again that our real victories are not over others, but over ourselves, to help us discover the eternal irony that in losing our lives, we find them. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone will hear my voice, I will come in. Christianity survives despite what we do to it, because some of us are forever finding out that this is the guest we've been waiting for all along.